You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is Friday. It is 1 o'clock. It is time for the next upcoming show, Skald's Hall. I am your host, Brian McDonald, and this is the show that I'm supposed to do. So, not a fill-in. And you were just listening to Episode 1, Act 1 of Adam Frank's Some Mad Scientists. Before that, you were listening to an interview with Toru Furuya, who is the guy who did a lot of voiceover work in Japan. He was the title character in Saint Seiya. He was Tuxedo Mask on Sailor Moon. And a few months back, we got a chance to catch up with him and get an interview. And this is the only English Language Institute that managed to get a chance to broadcast it, because I was the only person there who was not from a Japanese language media outlet who was at that interview. So that was pretty cool. Now, coming up in a moment, we're going to have an interview with Adam Frank that we did a little while ago, and then we're going to take a listen to Act 2 of Some Mad Scientists. So that's coming up in just a moment. Don't go away. Let's get started here at Skald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM in incredibly snowy Vancouver.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
You're tuned into CITR 101.9 FM in Skald's Hall, and we are here with our next guest, Adam Frank. Hello, Adam.
Hi.
How are you today?
Pretty good.
Well, tell our guests and listeners out there, who is Adam Frank?
I'm a writer and a teacher. I teach in the English department here at UBC, and mostly I work on 19th and 20th century American literature and poetics and media stuff. I teach a course on television. I've been interested in radio and teach a lot of film in my courses, so it kind of go across various media.
Now you've produced an audio drama.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, so Some Mad Scientists is my second full-length audio drama. The first one, called Overpass, a Melodrama, was also a collaboration with a composer named Sam Shalabi. We had been doing some work together for a while, for kind of the last 10 or 12 years, I guess. So this just kind of grew out of our collaboration and out of some interest.
What got you into producing audio dramas rather than just teaching about media?
Sam asked me to write liner notes for his first solo CD about 12 years ago. And what I did was I ended up writing, instead of a kind of piece of critical whatever, prose, I wrote a short play. And he liked it, and he said, we should not waste this on liner notes, we should just, you know, write a few more of these and we'll set the whole thing to music. So we kind of started collaborating on music. We called it opera, tongue firmly in cheek, because the kind of thing it wasn't opera, but it was word and music put together in some way.
Did this collaboration carry on to your most recent project?
Yeah, he did the music for Some Mad Scientists.
What is Some Mad Scientist?
It's an adaptation. It's a sort of re-adaptation of a pretty obscure ancient Greek text that describes an encounter between two major figures in ancient Greek philosophy, Democritus and Hippocrates. And it's interesting to me because it was described by the critic Bakhtin as the first instance where you have the maniac theme, what he calls the laughter of mad science. So I was really interested in finding out more about this text that described this kind of scene of mad science, which has long been at least an obsession of mine, if not sometimes a habit.
Are you involved in sciences yourself at all, as a hobby?
Well, I mean, as a younger person, I was interested in pursuing sciences, yes, before I got converted, if you want to put it that way, to the language arts, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the journey of creating your audio dramas.
Well, I had no idea what I was doing. What I was excited by is the fact that anyone can do it with relatively little equipment and, you know, as you know, this kind of freedom to just put something together. And then, I mean, I'm also, as a writer, interested in bringing the work that I write into some kind of performed form. And so it seemed that audio drama was a really great way to go about this. And mostly it was just making every single mistake you could possibly make. At first, I thought for Overpass, for example, I was doing a documentary, and it took me about 8 months to figure out that I wasn't doing a documentary, but I was using documentary material and integrating it with other sort of fictionalized material. So mostly it's been trial and error in my experience.
Did you voice the whole thing yourself?
No. Some mad scientist I used real actors. So the first project, I used people who lived in my building. I used, you know, people I knew, amateurs, like, you know, untrained voice people, but people whose voices I kind of liked. And some mad scientist, I had a contact at VFS, at the Vancouver Film School, and he got interested in the project, and we put together a group of actual actors and recorded them in a studio, and it was sort of semi-professional, I would say.
Did you do the directing yourself?
Yes, and that's one thing that I've learned. Never direct your own work. One of the things that I've learned since I'm a scientist is it's always better to hire a director or to have someone direct your work for you. And that's one of the regrets I have about some mad scientists. We've done it now as a theater workshop presentation at the Belkin Gallery here at UBC, and it was directed by Alex Ferguson, who's connected to theater here. And that was really interesting to see someone else take it in hand and have different ideas about it. That was very exciting to me.
Do you have any plans to do future audio dramas?
Yeah, right now I've got a big project called Radio Free Stein, which is a project to take as many of Gertrude Stein's plays as possible, the ones that make sense in radio form, and make them into radio. I'm doing one right now with a composer named Dorothy Chang at the School of Music here, and that's directed by Adam Henderson, and we are doing a concert staging of this, actually, at the Western Front in early May, and I'm just finishing up editing the audio on that now, basically, this month.
What advice would you give to people who are just starting out, who might be interested in pursuing similar work?
Make all the mistakes you can. I still feel like I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm just learning as I go along. And so I don't yet feel like I'm in a position to impart much in the way of, you know, wisdom, words of wisdom. Radio is such a weird medium because it's got all these formula, but the formula don't need to be followed because it's not, you know, what we think of as radio is not around in the same way it used to be. So you can kind of do whatever you want, as far as I can tell. And I'm interested in finding out what I can do.
Can you give us the online links where we can find your work?
Sure. Some Mad Scientists has its own dedicated website. It's www.somemadscientist.org. That's O-R-G. Radio Free Stein does not yet have a website, and I'm hoping to develop one if I get this big grant that I'm finding out in the next month or so. And an Overpass is available, actually, on CD from Alienate Recordings. It was released in 2007.
Do you have any final parting thoughts you would like to share with us?
I'm very interested to find out how people find this work, which I enjoy making, and I find, you know, works in its own ways. I'm interested in finding out how music and words can go together in ways that aren't like song and aren't like opera. So any feedback that people have for me about this is something I'm really interested in, so don't hesitate to get in touch with me.
So there you have it. You can listen to the audio drama from its source, and we will also be airing it in just a few moments here on Skulls Hall. So, listeners out there in the radio world, take a listen and give active feedback. Thank you.
Look at that guy's beard. What's he got on his head?
Hey, buddy, we don't want your type here.
Yeah, what are you, some kind of terrorist?
Hey, be nice, okay? This bus is a safe harbor. This man deserves respect. Doesn't everybody?
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
Thank you very much for being on our show.
Thank you, Brian.
I'm hungry. I'm hungry. I am hungry!
Shush, my dear. I bring your dinner here. The council asked and paid me to feed and tend you. Oh, be grateful, then, to them and me. When you feel better, I'll make your dress for festival time.
Medicine heals the diseases of the body while wisdom frees the soul from the passions. Do you feed me medicine or wisdom?
Neither, miss. Food and clothing is what you get from me. Mm-hmm. Will that do?
Thank you.
Your appetite is good. You were hungry. Now, rest quietly this evening.
Hungry. Yes.
And angry, too. I might have killed her with this knife. As many evils as one could conceive of come about through immoderate fits of anger. But is anger itself an evil? It may bring about bad things when unchecked. Yes. Just now it told me something. Brought me news. My body whispers, I need nourishment. And anger repeats this loudly. Neither my body nor anger is at fault. These are simple truths of their natures. Feed me now. Yes. So, anger can bring about good things too. Or necessities. If the body brought a suit against the soul. Oh, how does it go? If the body brought a suit against the soul for all the sufferings and ills it had endured throughout its whole life, and one had only oneself to judge the case, one would gladly condemn the soul for having ruined certain features of the body through carelessness, and made it soft through drink, and brought it to ruin through love of pleasure. Just as if a tool or utensil were in a bad state, one would blame the person who used it carelessly. So, the soul makes the body suffer. The soul is its prison. Some say it's the other way. The body is a nuisance, too many passions, a distraction, a source of evil deeds. But this is a mistake. Anger, say, is an event. Something vital. A danger. My soul decides to act or not act. Whether to kill or not. Anger insists on my attention and my care. Insists. Yes. Anger, then, is no more of the body than of the soul. It suffuses, it infuses, comes from without where the gods live, then pauses with me for a time. Democritus, you say my body is ruined through drink or pleasure. True. I have been careless, and admit that I am soft. I see no wrong in being soft at times. You once appreciated my body for its softness. What kind of tool or utensil is it, Master? You once said, use servants like parts of the body, one for one thing, one for another. To increase our enjoyment. This, then, must be the proper use of a body, to give us pleasures, joys. Parts of my body are speaking to me. I hear them say, I served you. I gave you enjoyment. I pleased you. We were well used by you. It's a chorus now. They sing, use us well. Enjoy us. For ill use begins when pleasure fades. Yes, yes, I hear them. Enjoyment calls for my attention. But my attention wavers, skips, and jumps. You say, from the very same things as benefit us, we may also get evils. What gives us joy can cause distress. Even a well-used and cared-for body can be hurt or taken ill. So, what does sorrow set in store? My master used to say, he missed me. I saw him, bleeding from his throat, send his love to me. What clarity I felt. What confusion. It's true what you say. The mind undoes at death, floats to the surface of the skin, and dissipates. Oh, my head aches. It tells me to stop, to seek assistance. Who can guide me now?
Five days! The winds have been favorable, Hippocrates. We reach Abdera tomorrow. Poseidon is surely with us.
This fine vessel flies, Damagetes. You have fit it with wings, not oars, as suits the urgency of our business there.
Let us drink this last night to the success of your mission. Bring some wine, servant!
Yes, Malamet, bring the skins. I see that you enjoy our wine. You shall have a cask of it when we return. I promise that.
I've been thinking of this business of yours. You are aware of their reputation, the Abderites, I mean. What they say can't be trusted, Hippocrates. Not that they lie, but they're thoughtless, mindless, foolish, stubborn, wrong-headed, ignorant. At Rhodes, there are many jokes. Let's see. An Abderite tries to hang himself. The rope snaps. He bumps his head, so he goes to the doctor to get a plaster. He feels better, thanks the doctor, then goes home and hangs himself.
The wine, master.
Thank you, Malamet.
Don't spill any, slave!
The swelling sea makes me unsteady.
A few months at sea would teach you to stand. Well, Hippocrates, I raise this cup to the fools of Abdera, and to the health of their philosopher.
Yeah.
It's true, my friend Damagetes, that the Abderites may be mistaken. It is remarkable the sympathy they have for him, as if they too have fallen ill. Yet I suspect that Democritus may not be mad.
What then?
The Abderites claim that he has too much wisdom, yet such excess is never harmful. Those who lack something good often consider someone else's abundance to be excessive.
You diagnose the Abderites, Doctor.
Master, may I speak?
Of course.
While it is true that the Abderites may be mistaken, Master, their observations, taken together, do point to a specific disease.
What have they observed?
They say that Democritus is sleepless, that he talks to himself and laughs inappropriately. They say he lives apart from others, mostly in deserted places. I would diagnose such a patient with melancholy, an excess of cool black bile. In addition, Democritus may suffer from an excess of yellow bile, which would explain the strange fits of laughter.
Is it true what he says?
It is. Of course, if Democritus has melancholy, I will try to cure him. But I suspect something else. Some surpassing strength of soul. When people are serious about learning, other thoughts and passions take flight. These thoughts are like slaves who make noise and quarrel with one another, then fall silent when the mistress of the house enters.
You believe Democritus to be wise then, capable of exerting self-control?
Yes. He may scorn human affairs because he wants freedom from disturbance. The mind, when it is tired of external stimulation, brings the body to some peaceful spot. There it stands up and looks at the place of truth within, where there is no father, no wife, no children, no mother, no brother, no kin, no slaves, no chance, nothing that can introduce confusion. Perhaps Democritus has been moved to that place by wisdom. And since he has traveled so far away and no longer sees his fellow citizens, he is considered mad, all because he wants to be alone.
Well, Hippocrates, if I lived among such fools as the Abderites, I too would want to be alone.
Tomorrow we'll decide between my diagnosis and Malamet's. And so, we should rest before our work.
Yes, we arrive early tomorrow. Good night, Hippocrates. Sleep well. And have your servant leave the wineskin.
Certainly, Damocles. Good night, good night. Malamet, lead me down. My old eyes don't see so well anymore.
Huh? Who's there?
I came to Athens and no one knew me. I am Democritus.
Yeah, the philosopher.
We are legion, numberless. I am but one.
Come in, quickly. The guard will come if you are seen. The council wants you under quarantine. Why do you wander? Have you eaten?
I am no longer hungry.
Sit down then, maiden. I must work. You see these half-made shoes?
I seek assistance with my soul. I have questions. Can you help me?
With your soul? Not likely, if mine is an example of my workmanship.
Thinking new things every day. I have received a taste, a glimpse. Enough to know, not enough.
Received from who?
From my master.
Are you a slave, then?
No more than you. I am free. There is a vase dedicated to Apollo in my name. Your mother was a slave.
Do you know me?
Everyone needs shoes. Few can make them. You are a workman of citywide renown.
I have been working at this trade for more than 50 years.
Why?
Why?
Why this trade?
It was no choice of mine. My father sent me out to learn this skill when I was 10 years old. My clumsiness was beaten from me early on. I learned quickly.
Your father, your master.
He freed me when he freed my mother, to marry her.
They are alive?
No more.
And you are married?
Once, no longer. Why these questions?
I remember now. My stomach speaks. To one who is self-sufficient in respect of food, the night is never short. Friend, I need a trade. Can you teach me?
Teach you what?
Shoemaking.
Ha! Absurd. Women don't make shoes.
I seek some way to maintain myself.
You are young enough, my dear. Why not find a man to marry?
To marry is to have children, and children are neither necessary nor beneficial. My womb makes no demands of me now. Can you teach me your trade?
A strange request, my dear. Very strange.
I see that you are lonely. If you accept me as apprentice, I will offer you companionship in return. The comforts of my body.
You would give me your freedom?
No. But I would exchange my company for your instruction.
Come, my dear. Join me in some wine to think upon this matter more.
Very well.
Let us take our time.
If we can find it.
I have prepared your robe and bed. Is there anything else, Master?
No, you may lay down now. Sleep, sleep. May it come easily to us both. What is it, Melamet? Why are you standing there so still?
I remember.
Yes, yes. Speak, Melamet.
I remember the slave ship that brought me to Greece 19 years ago. Something about Damogetes. The thought of a master such as he.
Damogetes isn't so bad. A ship's captain, what do you expect? Melamet, you're trembling.
That ship, I remember, was my education as a slave. I did not understand at first. I learned what it meant for my body not to be my own. And when we arrived to the market at Kos, I was terrified. What good fortune it was you. Everything might have been different with another master. Such a small thing, mere accident.
What has become of you?
Would you ever sell me, Hippocrates?
Melamet, I would never give you up to anyone. Come sit with me. I too remember the market at Kos. What a beautiful boy you are.
I am no longer so beautiful.
It is the way of things. Youth drains away, taking the beauty proper to it. But think, in its stead, you have gained the wisdom of maturity. You have become most skilled in the arts of medicine. Remarkable. Your reputation amongst other slaves is very high.
You have been an excellent teacher.
And you, an excellent pupil. Remember early on when I named you in your own language. Oh, learned one.
Such a name for a young boy. I was and am grateful.
Ah, you have always been a pleasure to instruct. I fear now there is little left for me to teach you. Melamet, stay in my bed tonight.
Fiends. Fiends. Ah! Away, fiends! Melamet! Asclepius! Protect me! Melamet! Melamet! Oh,
what is it? Does something ail you?
I have had a dream. A vision.
You are frightened.
I think it was a prophecy. Wait! Medicine and prophecy are closely related, since Apollo is the father of them both. Yes. I remember now. I do believe it to be a prophecy that bodes well. It tells me that beautiful truth lives with Democritus, while bold opinion dwells among the Abderites.
Such a prophecy should make you tranquil, Hippocrates. Yet you are very agitated.
The god Asclepius appeared in my dream. His serpents threatened me, his hands so hot it burned. Yet the vision was so clear.
But I am concerned. Why should this god be angry?
I am impatient to see Democritus and to experience this vision's truth.
As you say, master.
Hippocrates, we approach Abdera!
Hasten, Malamet, let us hasten!
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. It is roughly around 1:30. You are listening to Scald's Hall here in Vancouver. I am your host, Brian McDonald. Safety notice. Excuse me. It is cold and snowy outside. And I'm sure you know that already if you're here in the Lower Mainland. Be careful moving around today. I had to walk a decent part of the way here, which was not fun, seeing as how I live near the Burnaby boundary. And buses in the snow here in Vancouver, the accordion buses and the electric buses tend not to have the power to get up hills when it is snowy. So if you're going anywhere that has a hill somewhere along the line, you might want to go and check the TransLink website to see when the buses will be running. If you have a mobile device while you're outside, do be careful moving around. And I just want to talk about something that's a little bit more grounded and down to earth, sort of, and then it goes out into space. Kind of interesting. I've been focused on getting my thesis done for the past couple of months, and it was actually based around a spoken word project that will probably eventually be on this show, and I've kind of been blinders on just looking at the immediate future for a little while, and then I have had time recently over the past few days to reflect now that I've have the thing in after 2 years. And I think that this is a time of year when a lot of us do have that time to reflect. And traditionally, it's a spiritual time of year for many traditions, especially. And nominally, the Christians, nominally I mean by they have named the season in the way that most of us know it as Christmas. And it is a time of year, I think, when we can start to think, wow, there's more to life, perhaps, than our immediate surroundings, our immediate goals. There are other things that we can and should strive for. And I mentioned this a couple of months ago about more traditional science fiction and how they used to use it to tell stories that could not otherwise be told, and how we kind of sort of don't do that anymore. And I want to kind of address that dichotomy today. I've discovered something that we decided to send into space to contact everybody. And I'm going to play for you now the first two tracks to a very special record. These are the first two tracks that were put on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And these are the examples of spoken word entertainment that will outlast us as a species, perhaps. even more so than the sorts of broadcasts like the one I'm doing. This broadcast will bleed out into space and kind of never stop so long as the physical laws of reality apply to it. Now, that might not ever be coherent again, but that's kind of the thing. And it's not just this broadcast, it's all the sorts of things that we do. Well, here's something that we decided was worth saying in an enduring way. So stay tuned and take a listen.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
Silema Chemen.
Oikinis poteste chairete. Eirenikos prosphilos elelithamen philoi.
Paz e felicidade a todos.
Gotwai Homa. Zuk Gotwai. Ping on Gin Hong Fai Lo.
Adanish Lushulmu.
Zdrastuite. Privetstvuyu vas.
Sawaddi ka sahai nai Thorani Phon. Phok rao nai Thorani ni kho song mitrajit ma thung than thuk khon.
Tahiyyatuna lil astiqa fin nujum. Ya layta yajma'una zaman.
Saluter la toate lume.
Bonjour tout le monde.
Mae lakmia.
Shalom.
Hola y saludos a todos.
Selamat malam hadirin sekalian, selamat berpisah dan sampai bertemu lagi di lain waktu.
Kay pacamatna pitapas maitapas rimapayast runasimip.
Oji giano.
Ashuli.
Namaskar. Bishe shanti hok.
Salvete qui cumque estis, bonam erga vos voluntatem abemus, et pacem per astra ferimus.
Shalom.
Hartelijke groeten aan iedereen.
Herzliche Grüße an alle.
Assalamu alaikum. Ham zameen ke rehne walo ki taraf se aapko khush aamdeed kehte hain.
Chân thành gửi tới các bạn lời chào thân hữu.
Sayın Türkçe bilen arkadaşlarımız, sabah şeriflerinize hayırlı olsun.
Konnichiwa, o genki desu ka?
Dharti ke basiyon ki or se namaskar.
Yehi dai hui an aur akanoizoid.
Tanti auguri e saluti.
Ai buon.
Siani bingalela makawe, sinifisela inkonzo ende. Ria dumelisa marena.
Sonada kaho.
Polor anons, borg kat navin, diezerki mikamazu chunneren antin, vochchunner.
Annyeonghaseyo.
Witajcie, istoty z zaświatów.
Prithvi basi haruvata, santimaya bhavishya ko shubhakamna.
Gowei to hao ba, women to hen shanglian nimen, you kong qing dao zer lai wan.
Mpone gabot nonse.
Hälsningar från en dataprogrammerare i den lilla universitetsstaden Ithaca på planeten Jorden.
Mibanji mivantuon svaku mwamba.
Prithvi upar vasnar ek manav taraf thi. Brahman na anya avkashma vasnar aone. Hardik abhinandan. A sandesho moe, vrto sandesho moklavsho.
Peresalaimo priviti iz našo svitu. Бажаємо щастя, здоров'я і многа еліта.
Дорут бар сакінін маварай آسمان ها. Бані آدم از آی یک پیکرند که در آفرینش ز یک گوهرند. چوز وی به درد آورد روزگار دیگر روزها را نماند قرار.
Желимо вам све найлепше са наше планете.
Сурджя таракар трутія грах Пруттвіру Бисва Брахманнар адивасі мананку абхинандан.
Musulayo mchabantu bensieno mukama bawe mirembe buryo
Namaskar ya prithvi lok tumara tanje shubha vichar pathotat
आणि त्यांची इच्छा आहे की तुम्ही या जन्मी धन्य हो.
थायकोंग बेंगयू निन हो निन जा बाबे उयेंग दे लाय उन जा जे हो.
Üdvözletet küldünk magyar nyelven minden békét szerető lénynek a világegyetemen.
Namaste. Telugu matlade janamul nunchi ma subhakankshalu.
Milí přátelé, přejeme vám vše nejlepší.
Namaste. Kannadigara paravagi subhashayagalu.
Sab logon ne maro ram ram pahunche. Hame athe raji khushi ha. Tuma uthe raji khushi reh jao.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Hey, Horace, give us 3 shots of your best bourbon. And have that Russian waiter I like bring it over.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Tune into CITR 101.9 FM every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. And you can also find the podcast on CITR.ca, iTunes, and my blog, rocketfromrussia.tumblr.com.
And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up to round out the hour, we're going to have The Hobbit. I did The Hobbit last year. I mentioned it last week. It is out in theaters today. And from what I can tell, it is an absolute bloody mess in comparison to what the story used to be. What did the story used to be? Well, why don't we find out here next on CITR 101.9 FM.
What a lived old Gollum. I don't know where he came from, nor who or what he was. He was Gollum, as dark as darkness, except for two big, round, pale eyes. He had a boat, and he rowed about quite quietly on the lake, for lake it was, wide and deep and deadly cold. He paddled it with large feet dangling over the side, but never a ripple did he make, not he. He was looking out of his pale, lamp-like eyes for blind fish, which he grabbed with his long fingers as quick as thinking. He liked meat, too. Goblin, he thought, good, when he could get it. But he took care they never found him out. He just throttled them from behind if ever they came down alone anywhere near the edge of the water while he was prowling about. They very seldom did, for they had a feeling that something unpleasant was lurking down there, down at the very roots of the mountain. They had come on the lake when they were tunneling down long ago, and they found they could go no further. So there their road ended in that direction. There was no reason to go that way, unless the great goblin sent them. Sometimes he took a fancy for fish from the lake, and sometimes neither goblin nor fish came back. Actually, Gollum lived on a slimy island of rock in the middle of the lake. He was watching Bilbo now from the distance with his pale eyes like telescopes. Bilbo could not see him, but he was wondering a lot about Bilbo. But he could see that he was no goblin at all. Gollum got into his boat and shot off from the island while Bilbo was sitting on the brink, altogether flummoxed and at the end of his way in his wits. Suddenly up came Gollum and whispered and hissed, "Bless us and splash us, my precious. I guess it's a choice feast. At least a tasty morsel it'll make us Gollum." And when he said Gollum, he made a horrible swallowing noise in his throat. That is how he got his name, though he always called himself My Precious. The hobbit jumped nearly out of his skin when the hiss came in his ears, and he suddenly saw the pale eyes sticking out at him. "Who are you?" he said, thrusting his dagger in front of him. "What is he, My Precious?" whispered Gollum, who always spoke to himself, from never having anyone else to speak to. That is what he had come to find out, for he was not really very hungry at the moment, only curious. Otherwise, he would have grabbed first and whispered afterwards. "I'm Mr. Bilbo Baggins. I've lost the dwarves and I've lost the wizard and I don't know where I am. And I don't want to know if only I can get away." "What's he got in his hands is?" said Gollum, looking at the sword, which he did not quite like. "A sword, a blade which came out of Gondolin." said Gollum, and became quite polite. "Perhaps she sits here and chats with it a bit, see, my precious. Likes riddles, perhaps, does it? Does it?" He was anxious to appear friendly, at any rate for the moment, until he found out more about the sword and the hobbit, whether he was quite alone, really, whether he was good to eat, and whether Gollum was really hungry. Riddles were all he could think of. Asking them, sometimes guessing them, had been the only game he'd ever played with other funny creatures sitting in their holes in the long, long ago before the goblins came. And he was cut off from his friends far under the mountains. "Very well," said Bilbo, who was anxious to agree, until he found out more about the creature, whether he was quite alone, whether he was fierce or hungry, and whether he was a friend of the goblins. "You ask first," he said, because he had not had time to think of a riddle. So Gollum hissed, "What has roots as nobody sees? He's taller than trees. Up, up it goes, and yet never grows." "Easy," said Bilbo. "Mountain, I suppose." "Does it guess easy? It must have a competition with us, my precious. If precious asks and it doesn't answer, we eats it, my precious. If it asks us and we doesn't answer, then we does what it wants, eh? We shows it the way out, yes?" "All right," said Bilbo, not daring to disagree and nearly bursting his brain to think of riddles that could save him from being eaten. "There are 30 white horses on a red hill. First they jump, then they stamp, then they stand still. That was all he could think of to ask. The idea of eating was rather on his mind. It was rather an old one, too, and Gollum knew the answer as well as you do. Chestnuts, chestnuts, he hissed. Teeth, teeth, my precious, but we's only six. Then he asked his second. Voiceless it cries, wingless flutters, toothless bites, mouthless mutters. Half a moment, cried Bilbo, who was still thinking uncomfortably about eating. Fortunately, he had once heard something rather like this before, and getting his wits back, he thought of the answer. Wind, wind, of course, he said, and he was so pleased that he made one up on the spot. This sort of puzzled the nasty little underground creature, he thought. An eye in a blue face saw an eye in a green face. That eye is like to this eye, said the first eye, but in a low place, not in a high place. Said Gollum. He had been underground a long, long time, and was forgetting this sort of thing. But just as Bilbo was getting impatient, Gollum brought up memories of ages and ages and ages before, when he had lived with his grandmother in a hole in a bank by a river. My precious, he said. Sun on the daisies, it means it does. But these ordinary above-ground, everyday sort of riddles were tiring for him. Also, they reminded him of days when he had been less lonely and sneaky and nasty, and that put him out of temper. What is more, they made him hungry. So this time he tried something a bit more difficult and more unpleasant. It cannot be seen, cannot be felt, cannot be heard, cannot be smelt. It lies behind stars and under hills and empty holes it fills. It comes first and follows after, ends life, kills laughter. Unfortunately for Gollum, Bilbo had heard that sort of thing before, and the answer was all round him anyway. Dark, he said, without even scratching his head or putting on his thinking cap. A box without hinges, key or lid, yet golden treasure inside his head, he asked to gain time, until he could think of a really hard one. This he thought had dreadfully easy chestnut, though he had not asked it in the usual words, but it proved a nasty poser for Gollum. He hissed to himself, and still he did not answer. He whispered and spluttered. After some while, Bilbo became impatient. Well, what is it, he said. The answer's not a kettle boiling over, as you seem to think from the noise you're making. Give us a chance. Let it give us a chance, my precious. Well, said Bilbo, after giving him a long chance, what is it? But suddenly Gollum remembered thieving from nests long ago, and sitting under the river, teaching his grandmother to suck eggs, as it is. Then he asked, alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsty, ever drinking, all in mail, never clinking. He also, in his turn, thought this was a dreadfully easy one, because he was always thinking of the answer. But he could not remember anything better at the moment. He was so flustered by the egg question. All the same, it was a poser for poor Bilbo, who never had anything to do with the water if he could help it. I imagine you know the answer, of course, or can guess it as easy as winking, since you are sitting comfortably at home and have not the danger of being eaten to disturb your thinking. Bilbo sat and cleared his throat once or twice, but no answer came. After a while, Gollum began to hiss with pleasure to himself. Is it nice, my precious? Is it juicy? Is it scrumptiously crunchable? He began to peer at Bilbo out of the darkness. Half a moment, said the hobbit, shivering. I gave you a good long chance just now. It must make haste, 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 said Gollum, beginning to climb out of his boat onto the shore to get at Bilbo. But when he put out his long, webby foot in the water, a fish jumped out in a fright and fell on Bilbo's toes. Whoa, he said, it's cold, clammy. And so he guessed. Fish, fish, he cried, it's a fish. Gollum was dreadfully disappointed. But Bilbo asked another riddle as quick as ever he could, so that Gollum had to get back into his boat and think. No legs lay on one leg. Two legs sat near on three legs. Four legs got some. It was not really the right time for this riddle, but Bilbo was in a hurry. Gollum might have had some trouble guessing it if he'd asked it another time. As it was, talking of fish, no legs were not so very difficult, and after that the rest was easy. Fish on a little table, man at table sitting on a stool, the cat has the bones. That, of course, is the answer, and Gollum soon gave it. Then he thought the time had come to ask something hard and horrible. This is what he said. This thing all things devours. Birds, beasts, trees, flowers. Gnaws iron, bites steel, grinds hard stones to meal. Slays king, ruins town, and beats high mountain down. Poor Bilbo. He sat in the dark thinking of all the horrible names, of all the giants and ogres he had ever heard told of in tales, but not one of them had done all these things. He had a feeling that the answer was quite different, and that he ought to know it, but he could not think of it. He began to get frightened, and that's bad for thinking. Gollum began to get out of his boat. He flapped into the water and paddled to the bank. Bilbo could see his eyes coming towards him. His tongue seemed to stick in his mouth. He wanted to shout out, "Give me more time! Give me time!" But all that came out with a sudden squeal was, "Time! Time!" Bilbo was saved by pure luck. That, of course, was the answer. Gollum was disappointed once more. And now he was getting angry and also tired of the game. It had made him very hungry indeed. This time he did not go back to the boat. He sat down in the dark by Bilbo. That made the hobbit most dreadfully uncomfortable and scattered his wits. "It's got to ask us a question, my precious. Yes, yes, yes. Just one more question to guess. Yes, yes," said Gollum. But Bilbo simply could not think of any question with that nasty, wet, cold thing sitting next to him and pawing him and poking him. He scratched himself. He pinched himself. Still, he could not think of anything. "Ask us! Ask us!" said Gollum. Bilbo pinched himself and slapped himself. He gripped on his little sword. He even felt in his pocket with his other hand. There he found a ring he had picked up in the passage and forgotten about. "What have I got in my pocket?" he said aloud. He was talking to himself. But Gollum thought it was a riddle, and he was frightfully upset. "Not fair! Not fair!" he hissed. "It isn't fair, my precious. Is it? Not fair, is it? To ask us what it's got in his nasty little pockets is?" Bilbo, seeing what had happened and having nothing better to ask, stuck to his question. "What have I got in my pocket?" he said louder. "S-s-s-s-s-s," hissed Gollum. "He must give us three guesses, is he, my precious? Three guesses, is?" "Very well, guess away," said Bilbo. "Hatties," said Gollum. "Wrong," said Bilbo, but luckily just taking his hand out again. "Guess again." "Shh, shh, shh," said Gollum, more upset than ever. He thought of all the things he kept in his own pockets. Fishbowl, goblin's teeth, wet shells, a bit of bat wing, sharp stone to sharpen his fangs on, and other nasty things. He tried to think what other people kept in their pockets. "Knife," he said at last. "Wrong," said Bilbo, who had lost his some time ago. "Last guess." Now Gollum was in a much worse state than when Bilbo had asked him the egg question. He hissed and spluttered and rocked himself backwards and forward and slapped his feet on the floor and wriggled and squirmed, but still he did not dare to waste his last guess. "Come on," said Bilbo, "I'm waiting." He tried to sound bold and cheerful, but he did not feel at all sure how the game was going to end, whether Gollum guessed right or not. "Time's up," he said. "String or nothing," shrieked Gollum, which was not quite fair, working in two guesses at once. "Both wrong," cried Bilbo, very much relieved. He jumped at once to his feet, put his back to the nearest wall, and held out his little sword. He knew, of course, that the riddle game was sacred and of immense antiquity, and even wicked creatures were afraid to cheat when they played at it. But he felt he could not trust this slimy thing to keep any promise at a pinch. Any excuse would do for him to slide out of it. And after all, that last question had not been a genuine riddle according to the ancient laws. But at any rate, Gollum did not at once attack him. He could see the sword in Bilbo's hand. He sat still, shivering and whispering. At last Bilbo could wait no longer. "Well," he said, "what about your promise? I want to go. You must show me the way."